Sandy, thank you very much indeed. I'm absolutely amazed at how many people are here, actually, but thank you very, very much for turning up. And I need to give a notice before I begin. September the 9th to the 19th, if you want to go to Assisi, talk with Andrew Tuck afterwards, because he's going to run a pilgrimage there. Costs round about, where's Andrew? Andrew, costs about £1,000 plus the airfare to go on pilgrimage to Assisi. If you've never been to Assisi, it's utterly, utterly lovely. I've been several times, and Jan and I loved it whilst we were there. To be honest, before I went, I thought, oh, it's going to be full of religious tat, you know, sort of winking Jesuses as you walk past. And it wasn't. It wasn't at all. It's very holy, very special, very quiet. It's a very, very special place. And especially if you walk down the hill to San Damiano, where St. Francis first had a vision. So, September 9th to the 19th, have a word with Andrew afterwards. Some of you may know I'm quite fond of detective stories. And recently, I've been reading three books in the Dark Iceland series by a man called Ragnar Jonasson. His heroine detective is a woman called Hulda Hermannsdottir. Now, it's a very strange series because the first book takes place when Hulda is 64 years old and is a detective inspector. That's the first book in the series. The second book is a prequel when she's 50. The third book in the series centres on her life when she was in her 40s. So it goes backwards from the first when she was 65 back to when she was 40. So it's an odd way to create a heroine. But there's another twist. The name Hulda, H-U-L-D-A, in Icelandic means hidden one. And her surname, Herman's daughter, means daughter of Herman, of course. And Herman in Icelandic means soldier. But as Hulda was conceived in a one-night fling between her mother and an American GI based in Iceland, her surname, Herman's daughter, may well be related to that. And her first name, Hulda, the hidden one, may also relate to that. It's all sort of slightly curious, but I find it very lovely. So I asked myself, what has this to do with Luke's gospel? And I put in here, if I ask that properly, Keith Newman will say, not very much. Well, well, actually, I want to suggest that there are some similarities, strangely enough. So to begin with, and I've given you copies of the text that I'm going to use. So to begin with, here's Luke's opening sentence, as it's translated in the New Revised Standard Version, which is the Bible I use daily. So here we go. Since many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitness and servants of the word, I too decided, as one having a grasp of everything from the start, to write a well-ordered account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may have a firm grasp of the words in which you've been instructed. That's the translation of the New Revised Standard. I have got it here in Greek, New Testament Greek, Koine Greek, but to be honest, my Greek is now so rusty, I'm not going to attempt to read it, but if anybody wants, here's New Testament Greek, and here's New Testament Greek with English words underneath, which Andrew Tuck and I were talking earlier. This is the one that got us through our Greek examinations a few years ago. So, I'm now going to use the Authorized Version translation of the 17th century. This is what the Authorized Version says. For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus, that thou mightest know the certainty of those things wherein thou hast been instructed. Now, you'll notice that both those translations, Luke refers to somebody called Theophilus. That could be, it could be the name of a real person, but as the name also means lover of God, perhaps Luke is using it as a kind of literary trick. In the same way, here's my connection with my Icelandic novel, in the same way that Ragnar Jonasson uses the name Hulda Hermannsdottir in his novel. So perhaps Luke, perhaps, he's just assuming that all his potential readers are lovers of God. Well, who knows? Or maybe, and actually I think this is most likely, because books were usually commissioned by someone rather than being easily available from a bookshop, but let me say bookshops did exist in ancient Rome. You could go there and get a scroll, perhaps a codex. Perhaps there really was a man called Theophilus who commissioned Luke to write his gospel. That was the normal pattern. If you wanted a book or a bit of history, you found your author and you said, can I commission you to write it? You didn't write on the off chance that you'd be able to sell it down the market. So, I've been thinking of this as well. Because opening sentences of novels and biographies are often pondered over by their authors to grab the reader's attention, just think of Jane Austen's opening line of Pride and Prejudice. Oh, it's gorgeous, isn't it? It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Oh, can you imagine being able to write a sentence with that kind of balance and beauty? It's wonderful. But so it is with Luke. I want to suggest that his very first sentence is designed to grab attention. But I'm also going to argue that it's actually very complex. But I want to say something else, which is even more important. What we need to realize is that when Luke wrote his opening sentence, he probably did not write it in the way we might have done. We would sit down with a pen and paper, or if you prefer, with a laptop, and we would not utter a sound as we wrote. But Luke, and all writers in that period of history, when he wrote, as he wrote the words, he sounded out each individual word as he wrote it. This is what Irene Vallejo writes in her fascinating book called Papyrus. I do recommend it to you. It's about the history of writing and reading. And she said this: from the earliest centuries of writing up to the Middle Ages, the norm was to read aloud for oneself or others, and writers uttered their phrases as they wrote them. Listen to this: listening to their musicality. That's a beautiful phrase. So as you're writing it, you are listening to the sound of the words, as well as what we would say, well, so what's the meaning? Well, the meaning is partly in the word itself and partly in the very sound of the word as it's read aloud and as it's written aloud. And for me, that puts an entirely different slant on how we might approach the gospel. Perhaps the sounds of the words, their musicality, mattered as much as the actual sequence of the words in a sentence. Just going to go back to the Authorized Version. So you'll see that the New Revised Standard Version begins, since many have undertaken. The Authorized Version, for as much as many. Now, as soon as you use the word for as much, there's already a rhythm developing. And I love it. Whereas since is, let's go and buy a packet of cornflakes. Since is just kind of obvious, whereas for as much, because when the Authorized Version was written, they were also writing in a slightly antiquated version deliberately, because they wanted to convey the seriousness of what they were doing. So I want to suggest that when we read Luke and read that opening chapter, indeed all the chapters, musicality of the words should be part of the way we think about it. So I'm going to concentrate now on that opening paragraph. I'm going to split it into its constituent parts. There are four statements. Number one, since many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, stop there. Why do I stop there? Because Luke places himself as one amongst many writers who the other writers about Jesus might have been, apart from Matthew, Mark and John, we don't know. But the fact is, we only have four surviving Gospels, though there were more, especially in the second century. For instance, all those Gospels called Gnostic, sort of secret knowledge. Give an example, the Gospel of Thomas, composed in the middle of the second century. So another question, why are there four Gospels? Why not five? Why not two? Why not seven? Well, who knows what the answer is? It might be chance, could be chance. Or it could be a reference to the four elements, earth, water, air and fire, or to the four cardinal points of the compass, north, south, east and west. Who knows? Look again at that opening sentence. Since many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, who is us in that opening phrase? Is the us the gathered believers, that is, a congregation in an early church, or is us just some friends, or who is it? Is it the general public? Again, you can't answer it. That's part of the fun of the Gospels. You can't answer everything. Here's the second phrase. Just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. So you notice there that Luke is not claiming first-hand knowledge, but he is claiming that he has reliable and authentic eyewitness sources. Well, there's nothing unusual in borrowing sources from other people. That's what Shakespeare did. Raphael Holinshed, for example, and Sir Thomas North's translation of Plutarch. But in Luke's case, what does he mean by calling his sources, and I quote, servants of the word? You will know that the Greek word for word is logos. So is Luke using logos as a semi-technical or theological reference point? Most commentators seem to think it just means those who'd received the revelation of who Jesus was. But to me it suggests that phrase, servants of the word, might have already achieved a kind of accepted theological and ecclesiastical place in the early Christian community. I'm just going to talk about the word theology for a moment, because you can guarantee when clergy talk about theology, people glaze over because they think it sounds really rather highfalutin. But all it means is words about God, essentially, language about God, stories about God, the reasons for belief about God. So when somebody says, oh, that's very theological, that's all they're saying. So don't assume, I mean, there is, of course, a whole study of what people have thought about God from way back. But it's not, it shouldn't be an off-putting word. Anyway, here's the third phrase. I too decided, as one having a grasp of everything from the start, to write a well-ordered account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Now that's quite a claim when you look at it, that he's had, quotes, a grasp of everything from the start. If he himself was not present, who were his original eyewitnesses? So I'll take the who part of that question. Some people, I have to keep sort of making these sort of uncertain phrases, but it can only be said to be true. Some people say that Luke had met Philip the evangelist. If you want the biblical verse, it's Acts chapter 21, verse 8. And he'd it's thought he met Philip the evangelist at Caesarea. Philip was, quote, one of the seven, that is, one of those chosen by the apostles to assist them in their work of social care, kind of early administrative social workers and officers. The implication of being one of the seven is that they knew Jesus personally. So perhaps, nobody can prove this, perhaps Philip was one of the eyewitnesses on whom Luke relied for his information. There is no evidence at all that I've been able to find, I don't think there is any evidence anywhere, that Luke had direct contact with one of the 12. There is a pretty well-founded tradition that says Luke was one of St. Paul's companions. For example, there's an early mention of a man called Luke in the Epistle to Philemon, in which Luke is referred to as a fellow worker. So there's a whole series of ifs. If Luke was close to Paul, Paul obviously knew the 12, the chances are that Luke might also have met them. I'm not going to get into this much, but there are passages in the Acts of the Apostles which biblical commentators refer to as the we passages. So suddenly it moves from third person narrative to first person narrative, and it's thought that that was Luke on his travels with Paul. So some say, others disagree. So if we can't be certain of his eyewitnesses, can't be certain, there are other possible sources for Luke's narrative. You will know that if you place Matthew, Mark and Luke side by side and compare them, they're called synoptic gospels, you'll see there are some passages in Luke which he has in common with Mark and with Matthew. Scholars have argued that these verses must have a common source, and in short, they reckon that Mark was that primary source for Luke. As it were, when he was working on his laptop, he had a copy of Mark by the side of him to sort of compare notes. That's what is thought. However, there are other passages, for example, the Beatitudes, which are in both Matthew and in Luke, but they're not in Mark. So where did those come from? Well, because this idea grew up in Germany in the 19th century, that source was called Q. It's the German word Quelle, Q-U-E-L-L-E, Quelle, meaning source. No one's ever discovered a copy of Q, so it's just a useful hypothesis. So we've got Mark and we've got Q. This is in Luke's Gospel. But there are some stories and verses in Luke which don't appear in either Matthew or Mark. For example, if you look for the story of the shepherds in Matthew or Mark, you won't find it. There's nothing about them anywhere. So where did that come from? Well, people say it came from Luke's own sources, and they call that L. So you've got Mark, which is M, you've got Q, and you've got L. And you put those together and you've got what eventually makes up Luke's gospel. So three written sources, or maybe just oral sources for Luke's gospel. Q, the unknown written or oral source. L, material which only Luke has. The rest is from a copy of Mark. And just to complicate things further, some, such as G.B. Caird, argue that Luke, first of all, had some random eyewitness stories, that was L, then combined his material from Q. Once that was done, he then said, oh, haven't seen Mark ever before, I better have a look at that and see what I can do and put it all together. Again, truth to tell, nobody knows exactly how Luke compiled his gospel. It's highly likely it was Mark and Q and L. But how he edited those together, well, scholars have argued for years and years. It's part of the fun of looking at the gospel. So Luke claims that his account is, quotes, well ordered. And that phrase should alert us to the possibility that he's got a big idea, capital B, capital I, a big idea in mind, some theme which will hold all his gospel together, what literary writers sometimes call the ruling metaphor. Which point I'm going to go slightly off piece for a moment, because we know that Luke also wrote another book in the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles. The opening sentence of that book goes like this: in the first book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day when he was taken up to heaven, after giving instruction through the Holy Spirit to the apostles whom he had chosen. After his suffering, he presented himself alive to them by many convincing proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. While staying with them, he ordered them not to leave Jerusalem, but to wait there for the promise of the Father. This, he said, is what you have heard from me. For John baptized with water, but you will be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now. So what is beginning to be clear is that Luke wants to emphasize a kind of chronological pattern. After Jesus' death, for Luke, Jerusalem is the center. But the Acts of the Apostles ends with Paul proclaiming the good news. Where? Answer, in Rome. In other words, Luke's story is the big idea about a dynamic, God-inspired movement from Jerusalem across to Rome, from the heart of Judaism across to the heart of Gentile territory. And that big idea, that ruling metaphor, shaped Luke's account in his gospel and shaped the Acts of the Apostles. Let's go to the final phrase in the opening sentence. So that you may have a firm grasp of the words in which you have been instructed. I thought, that looks as though Luke's talking to a confirmation class. Someone under instruction, or who has been under instruction, someone who's coming fresh to the Christian story, in brackets, as we all are. So, a few PSs to that first part of my talk. Firstly, Luke wrote in Koine Greek, vernacular Greek. It was the form of Greek spoken throughout the Mediterranean region, including Palestine. So another question from that, when were Luke's writings translated into Latin and then into English? Long story, but in essence, the first agreed translation of Luke from Greek into Latin was created by Jerome in the 4th century, late 4th century. So you go from Greek into Latin. Who translated Luke from Latin into English? Answer, John Wycliffe in the late 14th century. From Latin, mark you, not Greek. P.S. If all this is going on, which is the oldest surviving manuscript of Luke's Gospel? Answer, it's in Paris. And you'll have to go to the Bibliothèque Nationale and look for papyrus number 4. That's not the entire gospel, but it contains large parts of the first six chapters dating somewhere between the second and fourth centuries, probably written in Alexandria. So that's my second PS. Third PS, where did Luke live? Answer, very vague tradition. He lived at Antioch in Syria. Total guess. Nobody knows. But it's, you know, people like to know where authors come from, but that's a total guess. Fourth PS. Was Luke a Gentile or a Jew? There are arguments for both. It's generally thought that he was a Gentile who was a God-fearer. That is, he was a Koine Greek-speaking man who followed Jewish teachings, perhaps involved in synagogue life, then fell in love with the Messiah. Final PS. When was Luke's two-volume work first composed? Generally agreed date, only general, somewhere around 85 AD. That's a general sort of view. But some have argued it was written before the fall of Jerusalem. That happened in AD 70. Why do they argue that? Because neither Gospel nor Acts of the Apostles mention that cataclysm. And you'd have thought, if he'd written in 85 AD, he'd have said, and Jesus' prophecies were fulfilled when Jerusalem fell or whatever, but he didn't. So you can see why people say it might actually have been written in AD 65 or 70 or thereabouts. In other words, that gospel was not written until, at the very earliest, 32 years after Jesus' crucifixion. So that took 30 years. That would take us back now to the 1990s, 1985 or thereabouts. Can't do my maths, but it would take us back. So if you imagine Jesus' crucifixion in 1990, there's been 35 years at least until somebody started writing about it. So what was going on in between? The usual answer is to say, well, nobody was too bothered initially about writing things down because they were expecting the end of the world. So you wouldn't, you know, if you thought the end of the world was coming next week, you wouldn't bother to write it down. Somebody ought to tell the editor of the Times, no need to worry anymore, the end of the world's going to come in about 2 days' time with Trump exploding. So there we are. So the usual argument is the original disciples are beginning to die out. New Christians were developing in scattered places. So they began to say, we need to have some story, we need to have a record. So it's thought that those two things especially gave rise to the actual writing of the gospel. So 30 years because people were expecting the end of the world, 30 years because by then some of the original disciples were dying out, therefore new Christians wanted a kind of written record. Well, I'm going to go on a bit into the gospel because if you looked at the preface in some detail, I want to look at what follows immediately afterwards. And there are two chapters which are given over to the birth of John the Baptist. There's the Annunciation, the birth of Jesus, including those lovely shepherds turning up, and Jesus' early childhood. It's not on your papers, sorry. Most of that material is unique to Luke. Mark doesn't have the story of the shepherds, nor does Matthew. There is no mention of the Benedictus or the Magnificat or the Nunc Dimittis in Mark or Matthew or John. No mention of Jesus' childhood in Mark or Matthew, which when you think about it is rather strange. It's only Luke who gives us that picture, his picture of Jesus and Mary and those early years. So we don't know where Luke got those passages from. It's possible They were already circulating.